You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the June 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of Two for the Road, Natasha Lyonne and Jennifer Coolidge, interviewed by Rebecca Ford. What do you still want to do, and where do you see your careers going in 5 or 10 years? Coolidge, I've only had 2 Broadway experiences. I would like to do a great play. I want to do some very real stuff, documentary-type stuff, just things that I feel very passionate about. Lyonne, I'm excited to see that play, and I'm excited to see those documentaries. For me, I've written a movie, and I'd love to direct it. I just want to get into my whole Penny Marshall meets Fellini phase of life. I think that's the most happy I am, and I don't know if it's because I have a weird relationship with acting from being a kid. It feels like the area where my defects become assets. There's a lot of boxes that we put female filmmakers into, even by just labeling them female filmmakers. I want to get good enough to be a heavy. That way, those young girls can see that they can do whatever the F they want, that they can tell whatever story they want. Coolidge, I bet you have a lot of girls that idolize you. I bet you have a lot. Lyonne, I love heavy-duty ladies. I'm so happy that we are in this era. It's very important to me that it's not a trend. That other shit was the pits, the try-to-be-like-everybody-else-all-the-time game. I mean, strictly from a dieting perspective, it was unmanageable. I hated it. It was awful. Coolidge, not fitting into any slot is just the worst. There was a certain type of girl when I was coming up the pike that I couldn't be, and that girl was getting all the parts. But now, you're right, the doors have opened. You can be all sorts of things. Lyonne, Jennifer, I'm such a fan of yours. I really hope we get to do something together someday. American Pie 10. It's just us hanging out. You're in a convertible. We're just Thelma and Louise in American Pie 10. American Pie 30. Coolidge, I'm totally into it, I swear to God, so we'll plant the seed. We'll plant it. Thank you. Fond Farewells by Hilary Boussis, with the illustration of All the Stars by Carolyn Ridsdale. As they end their runs, we bid adieu to 14 series that left their mark. The Walking Dead, AMC. Can you believe that after a decade plus of daring rescues and gnarly deaths, AMC's flagship drama is shuffling to an end without a single character ever uttering the word zombie? Here's hoping Rick Grimes shows up for one last hurrah before the last bite. This is Us, NBC. With hugs and many tissues, the Pearson clan's timeline-twisting saga, an old-fashioned feel-good weepy which inspired imitators and made Sterling K. Brown a household name, has come to a close. Yet the slow cooker that so cruelly took Patriarch Jack's life remains at large. Insecure, HBO. Issa Rae's love letter to Los Angeles was as sure-footed as its characters were shaky. Confidently following Rae's Issa and Yvonne Orji's Molly as they fumbled their way through adulthood. Like its protagonist, the show only went deeper with time. You know what that is? Growth. Blackish, ABC. Though network TV's first family may have lobbed their final punchlines, Kenya Barris's universe lives on-ish. Freeform is still airing spinoff, Grownish, which follows the young adult adventures of Yara Shahidi's ambitious, aspiring fashionista Zoe. Better Call Saul, AMC. We could argue all day about whether Vince Gilligan and Peter Gould's Breaking Bad spinoff eclipses the original, but Saul is a masterpiece all its own, stuffed with gorgeous sequences and indelible performances. And yes, it is better than Breaking Bad. Queen Sugar, OWN. Before Succession, another group of fractured siblings struggled to hold on to the family business in a power vacuum. The Bartolone brood, suddenly the stewards of a Louisiana sugarcane farm. Come for the clashing personalities, stay for the thoughtful handling of heavy subjects. Dead to Me, Netflix. Few friendships are more unlikely than that of Jen Harding and Judy Hales, the mismatched pair at the center of Liz Feldman's pitch-black comedy. But that's the appeal of Dead to Me, which will debut its long-awaited third and final season this year after a barrage of delays. Penis, Hulu. Maya Erskine and Anna Conkle's hilarious, earnest, sometimes hard-to-watch comedy about a pair of best friends navigating the murkiest part of adolescence is truly too good to be forgotten. Killing Eve, BBC America. The Sandra Oh essence began with this irresistible cat-and-mouse thriller, which, despite an unpopular final episode, showed off an incredible array of female talent in front of and behind the camera, including Jodie Comer, Fiona Shaw, Emerald Fennell, and creator Phoebe Waller-Bridge. Ozark, Netflix. In 2017, Wendy and Marty Bird moved their kids to the titular region and embraced a life of money laundering, murder, and dubious couples counseling. After four riveting seasons, a bucket of Emmy love, and the skyrocketing of Julia Garner's career, it seems they made the right call. The Expanse, Amazon. There was broad scope and laser focus in this sci-fi series, a galactic epic that excelled in telling human stories, as well as giving Shore Agdishlu stunning outfits. Its last season focused largely on emotional catharsis, proving conclusively that in space, people can hear you form lasting connections. Peaky Blinders, Netflix. What exactly is a Peaky Blinder? You'll never know unless you devour this absorbing crime drama, which follows an Irish gang in post-World War England. Pro tip, the lads are speaking English, but closed captioning is a boon for American ears. Dickinson, Apple TV Plus, tell all the truth, but tell it slant. The opening line from one of Emily Dickinson's best-known poems doubles as the credo of Alina Smith's biographical comedy, which took charming liberty with the poet's life story, including a flash forward that allowed Emily to peek into the 20th century. Search Party, HBO Max. The worst people in the world make for compelling comedy. No show was sillier. There's a character named Dr. Amanda Baby, while skewering millennial myopia, peppering wild twist with uncomfortable truths. Now, here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco. Lily Tomlin, the writer and comedian on mantras, Weltschmerz, and the sublime joy of making Queen Elizabeth smile. What is your most marked characteristic? People tell me it's my smile. When my face is in repose, I can look quite serious or sad. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Filling out this Proust questionnaire, I try to be in the moment. What is your greatest fear? Being on stage and forgetting why I'm there. Which living person do you most admire? My partner, who's helping me with this Proust questionnaire. With which historical figure do you most identify? Eleanor Roosevelt, Harriet Tubman, Sappho. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? Impatience. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Cruelty. What is your greatest extravagance? Amazon.com. What is your favorite journey? I adore Greece. My second favorite is London, where I did a show. Queen Elizabeth attended, and I remember her turning to her companion, Lord Mountbatten, and smiling at something I said. What talent would you most like to have to be a fabulous singer? What is your greatest regret? Regrets, I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My partner, Jane Wagner. What is your current state of mind? Mindfulness is what I seek, but Weltschmerz is my current state. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? I wish more of them were alive, especially my mom and dad. What do you consider your greatest achievement? I feel I still have to achieve it, however time's running out. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? A goddess like Venus de Milo, but with both arms. If you could choose what to come back as, what would it be? A doctor without borders. Or maybe Ava Gardner. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Did I mention Weltschmerz? What is your favorite occupation? Working on a good part or a good production? Who are your favorite writers? Eudora Welty, Toni Morrison. There are so many writers who have touched me. My partner, Jane Wagner, Virginia Woolf, Lillian Hellman. What do you most value in your friends? That they are my friends. I trust them and they trust me. How would you like to sleep? How would you like to die, rather? In my sleep, dreaming android dreams of electric sheep. What is your motto? I have a transcendental mantra that I am supposed to keep to myself. Where would you like to live? Outside the box, always. And that was the Proust Questionnaire with Lily Tomlin. in the cloud, the Juul case. What we may have lost when the question of vaping got political, by Vanessa Grigoriadis. With opening photograph by Jamie Chung, showing a person vaping with their entire head obscured by smoke. Juul reached Decacorn status, a $10 billion valuation quicker than any company in Silicon Valley history. It is easy to forget now, given the speed with which we grew accustomed to the sight of our fellow citizens noisily dragging on devices that wouldn't have been out of place on the set of Dune. But it was only in 2015 that Juul cracked the code on the unembarrassing electronic cigarette. Juul's sleek USB-like design swiped away memories of earlier vapes, which were often clumsy metal representations of the real thing. The Juul was charged via computer port, giving it the feel of a well-polished Apple product appearing in your life to alleviate your anxiety. Anxiety being the issue many smokers know is at the heart of their addiction. It was the gadget of smokers' dreams, and for creating it, co-founders James Munsees and Adam Bowen were handsomely rewarded. Juul reached Decacorn status, a $10 billion valuation quicker than any company in Silicon Valley history. But Juul's rapid ubiquity and rise to such tech sector heights belied the small matter of its status with federal regulators. As it turns out, the devices have never been officially approved for use in the United States. For more than a decade, the FDA has punted the decision about whether e-cigarettes are a public health boon, leaving Americans to decide for themselves if vapes are a godsend with the potential to save the lives of millions of smokers, or the worst newfangled tech product to come along since the Zune, with the unfortunate side effect of potentially killing you. The FDA said it would weigh in when it had more information. Finally, in October, the agency granted word from on high that one favored e-cigarette was safe. It wasn't a Juul. Few who observed this fight were surprised by this outcome. For the past few years, Juul has been locked in a vicious battle with regulators, school districts, and states. To these antagonists, Juul is an immoral company that prized making billions over deep attention to the moral question at the heart of its controversial product. Is it worth saving the lives of some number of adult smokers by having Juul on the market if the price is nicotine addiction in young people, some number of whom will inevitably move on to combustible cigarettes and hasten their death? As the early leader in the space, Juul has traveled a bumpy path, drawing as much scrutiny as the Trump White House could muster, and becoming yet another Silicon Valley cautionary tale along the way. An FX New York Times docuseries about the company's rise last fall was titled Move Fast and Vape Things. Juul once had 75% of the vaping market share in the U.S. and was down to 42% last year, but the FDA-approved e-cigarette R.J. Reynolds Vuse Solo Power Unit is far less popular. The agency, it would appear, would never give Juul the satisfaction of being the first vape in America to attain authorization to market. It would rather let Juul twist a bit longer in the wind. So, what exactly happened to the one-time darling? How did we go from "Dude, where's my Juul?" and scrambling for lost Juul pods under the seats of our cars to regarding the company as the evil empire? And will we ever go back to a time when Juuling was a verb, like Googling, or will it be forever thought of as an unfortunate cultural moment on par with the Tide Pod Challenge? Vaping works by extracting nicotine from tobacco and turning it into a smokable liquid without setting it on fire. It's not nicotine that is toxic, but the tar and chemicals that come from combusting tobacco by lighting a cigarette. Half of the world's 1 billion smokers will die of smoking-related illnesses, making cigarettes arguably the most dangerous consumer product on the globe. But only Juul figured out how to make vapes so potent that they would satisfy smokers. Earlier rivals had exponentially less powerful blends of nicotine. The company had an elite pedigree. Monsees and Bowen created an early version of Juul as their product design master thesis at Stanford. They had a recombinant vision of marrying the tech and tobacco worlds, making both more humane and ethical, and spoke often about how Juul and its creme brulee flavored vapor would save lives by satisfying nicotine cravings, yet not hastening one's demise. Identifying a big, sweeping idea during our late age of tech, when VCs are more likely to be inundated with investment requests from companies delivering hamburgers than a humanity-saving piece of machinery, was a big deal. 3 years after they founded the company, Monsees and Bowen sold 35% of Juul to Altria, the company formerly known as Philip Morris Companies, for nearly $13 billion. But there was one large, potentially humanity-destroying problem. In order to make Juul as appealing to smokers as possible, and by that I mean delivering a nice buzz and head rush, Juul upped the percentage of nicotine in each vape over the potency of e-cigarettes authorized for sale in Europe, not a continent known for its lack of devotion to smoking. This head-buzzy Juul was pleasurable, but also insanely addictive. And it proved to be a hit not only with smokers, the group of people Juul claimed it was trying to save, but also with a group of people known for chasing head buzzes, namely teenagers. Youth smoking has been on the decline since the 1990s. That was its peak in the U.S., with 36.4% of teens reporting they smoked the previous month in 1997. This victory is one of the few bright spots in America's otherwise sad public health regimen. Obesity and alcoholism come to mind. Most of the country's 34 million smokers are not Gen X or older. Today, the habit doesn't only stain teeth, wrinkle lips, and age the face. Now, you look older just because you do it. But Juul destabilized this progress, turning an estimated 6 million American youths into nicotine fiends, according to Robert Jackler, a Stanford professor and key anti-vaping advocate. Left on the bedside table of a teenager, a parent wouldn't recognize it as a smoking device, and they became a thing for kids, like Beanie Babies, hula hoops, or fidget spinners, says Jackler. Juul could never have designed such a big fad, because no company could engineer that. But once it happened, they knew about it, and here's the rub. They went after it, and it succeeded beyond their wildest dreams. Juul violated a sacrosanct principle: do not market vices to American kids, or at least don't be so obvious about it. Around 2018, when some Americans started acquiring lung diseases from vaping, journalists and politicians pointed the finger at Juul, even though the people who fell sick were actually smoking marijuana that had been laced with a chemical that black market purveyors use as a thickening agent. During the Trump administration, Juul's most popular vapes, the ones with flavors, were pulled off the market. Juul hadn't created mango-tasting vapes expressly to attract teenagers. An industry survey showed more than 90% of vape users prefer flavors to tobacco-flavored nicotine, which is right up there with durian on the list of world's worst taste. But the fact that adults also favor flavored vapes was considered beside the point. Even if the company was dumb and greedy, and I think there is evidence to this effect, it paid a high price for being the prime mover in the e-cigarette revolution. By 2020, Altria was massively writing down its investment in Juul because the company could not function in the current U.S. regulatory environment. But if you think about smoking as a larger public health problem, it's also possible that Juul kickstarted the important process of moving Americans to e-cigarettes, one that now needs to be finished. The Biden administration seems to be thinking about how to move more smokers to vapes. They're working on a plan to decrease the potency of nicotine in smokable cigarettes, to push Americans toward every type of e-cigarette. Vaping isn't completely without risk. At least, we don't think it is. Addiction to nicotine can warp adolescent brains in a state of plasticity, and some data suggest a link between vaping and asthma, chronic lung disease, and an increased risk of cardiovascular disease in dual users, people who vape and also smoke cigarettes. In the rest of the world, many nations may have less incentive to help citizens get off cigarettes because they gather high taxes for their coffers from the products. China has effectively outlawed e-cigarettes. Indonesia is weighing a ban. In the Philippines, you can be arrested for vaping in public. America has a second chance with the FDA's new approval of at least one e-cigarette to do vaping right, and this time focus more deeply on the best way to truly save lives in the process. Crime and Punishment. She was walking home. The murder of Sarah Everard horrified a nation and exposed deep rifts in feminist approaches to criminal justice, by Melissa Jeltsin. Opening photo, a vigil to honor Sarah Everard ended in a display of police power. On the last night of Sarah Everard's life, she picked up a bottle of wine at a London grocery store and visited a friend before beginning her walk home. It was around 9 p.m. on March 3rd, and the 33-year-old marketing executive was wrapped in warm layers and wearing sensible sneakers. She took a main road, it is believed, that cut through Clapham Common, a park regularly populated by joggers and dog walkers. By 9:30 p.m., she was past the park and on Poynders Road, heading toward her neighborhood. The streets would have been emptier than normal, with pubs and restaurants closed due to the coronavirus lockdown. Sarah's image was captured briefly on a private doorbell camera as she walked by herself. Then she vanished. In the following days, the news of her disappearance hooked somewhere deep inside women in Britain and unleashed a wave of grief and anger. Online, women began sharing the everyday modifications they took to avoid danger in public. Walking with keys thrust between knuckles, avoiding dark streets, adjusting outfits to cover skin or obscure curves, calculating exactly what tone to use when responding to a stranger's greeting without provoking anger or inviting further conversation. The weight of this eternal vigilance came tumbling out in a stream of tweets and Facebook posts tagged hashtag she was walking home. Women in Clapham reported that they had been visited by police and advised not to venture out at night alone. The instruction was eerily reminiscent of what police told women in the 1970s when the Yorkshire Ripper, a notorious serial killer, was terrorizing Britain's female population. Back then, feminists in Leeds, bristling over the suggestion they should limit their personal freedoms to escape male violence, began organizing evening protest under the name Reclaim the Night. Was it possible that nearly 50 years later, this was the best advice law enforcement had to offer? The simmering anger reached a crescendo 6 days later, when police arrested one of their own, a Metropolitan Police officer named Wayne Cousins, and subsequently charged him with Sarah's kidnapping and murder. Alone in her apartment, Jamie Klingler, an event planner in her early 40s who runs the annual London Seafood Festival, was feeling useless and a little stir-crazy. I needed to see other women. I needed people who were as angry and upset as I was, she told me over coffee at a cafe in Soho. Somewhat impulsively, Klingler decided she would organize a vigil for Sarah and announced her intentions in a tweet. She soon learned that another group of women were planning the same thing, organizing under the name Reclaim These Streets, a nod to the earlier feminist movement. The women teamed up and over a series of Zoom calls planned a vigil for Saturday, March 13th. The plan was to hold a socially distanced mask event at the bandstand in the common, which was already serving as a makeshift memorial, blanketed in flowers and notes to Sarah. But when organizers reached out to law enforcement to ensure the gathering could go forward without violating lockdown restrictions, Klingler said, they were told that the event was illegal. The group went to court to fight for their right to protest, but ultimately felt they could not proceed without legal risk. On the morning of the vigil, Reclaim These Streets announced that the event was off. Klingler appeared on several television and radio programs to urge people to stay home and participate in a virtual vigil instead. It was, by that point, too late. A separate activist group, Sisters Uncut, which describes itself as an intersectional feminist direct action collective, encouraged people to show up regardless. "We are angry. We will not be controlled. We will not be silenced," they wrote on Twitter. Started by predominantly women of color, Sisters Uncut is concerned with compounding forms of oppression, how racism and misogyny and classism, for example, overlap to create graduated experiences of discrimination, and is deeply suspicious of police. To them, Sarah's death was not only a tragedy, it was also an extreme example of the harm law enforcement can pose to women, among other vulnerable populations. Reclaim These Streets, on the other hand, was motivated by a generic but genuine feeling of outrage about male violence. "None of our agenda has anything to do with the police other than more training," Klingler told me. Klingler did not attend the vigil out of concern that she would be fined as an organizer. Instead, sitting at her dining room table, she watched live coverage on the BBC. She had naively thought that the police would be respectful of the grieving women, envisioning them kneeling in solidarity, like some police did in the U.S., as protest over racial justice swept the country. At first, the police stood back, despite the violation of social distancing guidelines. Women took turns addressing the crowd, sharing raw stories of male violence. By 7 p.m., the police had had enough. Soon, they began to press in on the crowd, ordering people to disperse. "Who do you protect?" the women chanted back at them. When the vigil-goers did not move fast enough, police pushed them to the ground and began making arrests. Klingler watched, aghast, as the event she had imagined as a peaceful remembrance devolved into violence. "We were hearing women scream and watching flowers get trampled," she said, tearing up. At the vigil, Sisters Uncut had distributed a pamphlet arguing that the answer to violence against women does not lie with more police. But they needn't have. The heavy-handed actions of the men with badges made their point for them. Not all incidents of abduction or murder receive national attention, but Sarah's case dominated front-page news. She was young, pretty, and white, three factors that tend to influence media coverage, and it was easy to identify with her actions that night. If a woman wasn't safe walking home at 9 o'clock on a main street in London, where was she safe? The overwhelming public sentiment in the commentary following Sarah's death was that something must be done. But what? To some, Sarah's murder was evidence that more policing was needed to protect women from male violence. Others drew the opposite conclusion. By the time I arrived in London in April, Sarah's family had stopped talking to the media, retreating inside their pain like a cocoon. I got the impression that they felt she had been unwittingly turned into a national symbol, and that no one had bothered to ask how she would have felt about it. Sarah's cousin, Tom Everard, encapsulated his frustration in a tweet. "This is all just so crushingly sad. Sarah is the best. What happened was unspeakable, unimaginable, awful. But for her to be the lightning rod for this fury, however righteous..." No. Tragedies happen, as do acts of evil. No woman should be in fear, but take a breath, he wrote. Another one of Sarah's friends felt that her death had been hijacked by people with political agendas. "It is not a tribute to her anymore. It's about something else, and I don't like what it has become," Helena Edwards wrote in an article for Spiked, an online libertarian magazine. "Her abduction and murder is not, in my opinion, a symptom of a sexist, dangerous society. I will not be blaming men or the police for the actions of one individual. That one individual, 48-year-old Cousins, is now known to have used his police authority to perpetrate his crime. He detained and handcuffed Sarah, likely using COVID protocols as a pretense. A couple who was driving by told prosecutors they assumed he was an undercover police officer arresting a woman who had done something wrong. Instead, they were observing an abduction. Cousins pleaded guilty to the charges of kidnap, rape, and murder in the summer. On September 30th, he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. In announcing the sentence, Lord Justice Adrian Fulford said that Cousins had irretrievably damaged the lives of Sarah's family and friends and eroded the public's confidence in the police. Serious questions remain about the culture of policing that allowed Cousins to serve on the force despite a record of red flags. Before joining the Met in 2018, he was employed at the Civil Nuclear Constabulary, the armed police force in charge of protecting civil nuclear sites. There, he was nicknamed the Rapist, according to the tabloid The Sun, because his behavior made his female colleagues uncomfortable. In 2015, 6 years before he abducted Sarah, he was accused of indecent exposure after he was spotted allegedly driving while naked from the waist down. He is also accused of two incidents of indecent exposure in February 2021. According to news reports, Cousins allegedly exposed himself in a South London fast food restaurant 3 days before Sarah's disappearance. Met police are now facing an inquiry into whether the agency properly investigated the claim. Viewed through a wider lens, the tensions raised by Sarah's murder and the mishandled vigil illustrate one of the biggest rifts in the feminist movement in England and abroad today. What role the criminal justice system should play in addressing gender-based violence? Historically, many feminists, predominantly white, have found recourse in the law, arguing in favor of more aggressive policing, tougher laws, and longer prison sentences for perpetrators. The thinking is that once violence against women is deemed socially unacceptable and carries with it high penalties, behavior will change. But at a time of heightened awareness of police violence and racial inequalities in the justice system, a small but growing group of activists is questioning this crime-centered approach. Feminists like Maryam Kaba in the U.S. and Alison Phipps in the U.K. argue that not only are these measures not proven to work, but that broadening the powers of law enforcement, ostensibly to protect women, often ends up backfiring on those most vulnerable to violence. As they see it, carceral feminism, as this approach is called, neglects to take into account those who may be less likely to view law enforcement as a source of support, or worse, who view police as a very real threat, such as women of color, immigrants, sex workers, trans women, and lesbians. The prevailing emphasis on the safety of white, cisgender, middle-class women at the expense of others also helps explain the surprising strain of anti-transgender activism alive in UK feminism. Self-identified gender-critical feminist, more commonly known as TERFs, or trans-exclusionary radical feminist, often argue that women's safety is endangered by allowing trans people full equality. In this calculation, though, only one kind of woman matters. In the wake of Sarah's death, some activists urged the government to pass a law to criminalize street harassment, despite the somewhat tenuous connection between being catcalled, exceedingly common, and abduction and murder by a stranger, exceedingly rare. The Labour Party officially adopted this position in May when it released a policy paper outlining its plans to tackle violence against women. Labour agrees with campaigners who say public sexual harassment is a crime, not a compliment, the paper states. I spoke to Fiona Vera Gray, an assistant professor at Sarah's alma mater, Durham University, and author of The Right Amount of Panic, How Women Trade Freedom for Safety, about the concept. She said it would mean more policing of public spaces like parks, which would likely result in further oppression of already over-policed communities. She also thought it was unlikely black and brown women would avail themselves of the law. Feminists campaigning for law reform need to start having important conversations about who really is going to use that law and who is it going to be used against, she said. In the summer of 2020, two black sisters, Nicole Smallman and Biba Henry, went missing in a park in Wembley, northwest London, in a case with similarities to Sarah's. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.